Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, if we ask you this simple, straightforward question, what was the first world war? I think probably a lot of people would say, well, that's pretty easy. The first world war was World War I. However, in this part of Focus 580, we have a guest who's prepared to make the argument that, in fact, perhaps the first real world war took place sometime before that, in fact, 250 years ago, and did indeed involve the United States, as well as two of the major powers in the world at the time, England and France. The war that we're talking about, and we will talk about here this morning, is the one that here in the United States we call the French and Indian War, although other people, the Canadians, the French, and the British, they have other names for this. Our guest is William Fowler. He's an historian. He's director of the Massachusetts Historical Society. He's also a consulting editor at the New England Quarterly and is honorary professor of history at Northeastern University. He is the author of a recently published book a little bit earlier this year, which is titled Empires at War. The subtitle is The French and Indian War and the Struggle for North America, 1754 to 1763. Walker and Company is the publisher on the book, and if you're interested, you can certainly go out to the bookstore and take a look at it. As we talk this morning about the French and Indian War, certainly questions are welcome here on the program. The only thing we ask people who call in is people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, calls are welcome. Questions are welcome. If you're listening here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. And if you're here in and around Illinois and Indiana, as a matter of fact, if you'd happen to be listening on the internet, and as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. So again, here locally, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Fowler, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Let me ask you right up front to defend that that designation that, in fact, the French and Indian War might well be considered to be the first world war.
Well, it's a war, David, that starts off, of course, as I think as many of your listeners would know, in the Ohio Valley with a young militia colonel, major at the time, named George Washington, who attacks the French in an unprovoked fashion. And then it takes a couple of years for this war to sort of spread, but it does spread, and it spreads to the entire world, and that by 1756, 1757, the world's two great empires, France and England, were at war around the globe. They were fighting not only in Europe, they were fighting in North America, they were fighting in Africa, they were fighting in the West Indies, they were fighting in India, they were fighting in Asia and the Philippine Islands. They were fighting everywhere where they had imperial interests. And so it was indeed the first world war.
Well, and certainly here the part of the context is what we would now call superpower conflict.
Yes.
Between the British and the French. And indeed, what happened eventually had rather far-reaching implications for the histories of the United States, of Canada, and of Britain and France.
It did indeed, David. And in fact, the war really had worldwide implications because in 1763, at the conclusion of the war, it's fairly clear that Britain was the dominant imperial power. And so she would go on to create this vast empire. Now, I know here in the United States, we're fond of thinking that our revolution was a severe body blow to the British and to the empire, but that's really not true. It was, in many ways, a minor setback. And in fact, the Treaty of 1763 that launches Britain on this empire, this worldwide conquest, sets the stage for the Industrial Revolution. Because it's from her empire that Britain will garner the resources to fuel the Industrial Revolution, which, of course, then transforms the world in the 19th and well into the 20th, and into our own time, of course. So this is the war the French and Indian War, as we call it. In Europe, by the way, it's called the Seven Years' War. But this is the war that creates much of the modern world that we, lays the foundation, at least, for much of the modern world that we now live in.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that one of the reasons that when we came across this book, we thought that it would be a good thing to do was our feeling that maybe, speaking for ourselves, that our knowledge of the French and Indian War was kind of hazy.
Yes.
And in fact, I think probably for a lot of Americans, anything that happens before the Revolution and even some of the things that happened since, our knowledge of that is a little hazy. And I wonder why it is, given just how important that is, this is as a world event, but also in laying the groundwork for the American Revolution. Why is it that it seems that we don't know, most people don't know very much about it?
Well, I think that's quite true, that we don't know a lot about it. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that we tend, of course, to focus upon the American Revolution. That is the pivotal point in our history. And so we view backwards from the Revolution virtually, and you can see this sometimes in books and indeed in some teachers in classrooms, that everything that comes before the Revolution is somehow the prelude to it, and that the great event of our history is the Revolution. So we tend to merge things, to meld things, to see them as kind of a conglomeration before the Revolution. And we don't pay much attention to the events pre-1775, 1776. The other thing is, and I suppose this is a fault of us, is we know so little about our neighbor Canada. And, of course, Canada and the French in Canada at that time and later the British are critical to this entire enterprise. And we tend not to study our own history and our relationship with Canada in the period before the American Revolution. So it's a time in history that we pass by very quickly. James Fenimore Cooper, in his wonderful novels, of course, highlighted the period and intrigued, of course, generations, and still does intrigue generations of readers. But from an historical point of view, we often simply view this time period as a prelude to our revolution.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is William Fowler. He's director of the Massachusetts Historical Society, and he is author of a recently published book about the French and Indian War. That's what we call it here in the United States. It's titled Empires at War, and it's published by Walker & Company. And again, questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The first permanent settlement in North America was Jamestown, 1607, but the French were actually here earlier. The first French settlement was Quebec, and that was 1603. So even long before this war broke out in Canada, in the United States,
that's quite true.
Both the French and the British had been here.
That's true, and in fact, the French were actually in Florida even before that, contending with the Spanish. The Spanish soon drove them out. But this was a time that Cartier, the great French explorer, comes into the St. Lawrence and into a part of the world that the local natives call Canada. Canada. Don't quite know what that word means, but they kept repeating it. And so Cartier comes to call this region of the world Canada, more likely known in its own time, though, as New France. But you're right. The French are in North America very early on, 1600s. Samuel de Champlain, the great explorer. Champlain is one of the most underrated, I think, figures in early American history. And Champlain is there in Quebec. The Côte de Bois, the runners of the woods, the fur traders, very quickly expand and go inland from Quebec and Montreal. And the French, by 1615 or so, have reached Lake Superior. So that the French expand and explore a vast, vast territory. Not many of them, and of course that's one of their principal problems, is that the French are trying to hold a vast area with very few people. And then in the meantime, south of the border, the English are populating the eastern coast here, the colonies, the British North American colonies. And unlike the French, the British North American colonies have a fairly substantial population. And so the friction between these two cultures, between the French and the English, is inevitable.
Yeah. It seems interesting when you look at, you size up both sides in this conflict, that it's not entirely clear who had the advantage. Well, on the one hand, you would say that the English had more soldiers, had more troops, that the organization of the colonies was such that you had a lot of individual actors colonies had their own militias. The French, on the other hand, at least they were, there was one French government, and there was one source of direction. And so it's true that there were fewer settlements, but they would, you know, arguably maybe would be easier to defend because they were not that far apart. So you say, is it a toss-up who has the military advantage here?
I think you're right, and one of the things that struck me as I was doing my work on this war is it reinforced for me the importance of human intervention. That is, that one could do all the statistics comparing New France and the British colonies, and you're quite right. The population of New France at the time of the war was perhaps 60,000 people. The population of British North America was perhaps 1.5 million. But it was, in fact, the extraordinary courage and skill of many of the French soldiers, particularly the French Canadians, a group of people who are often simply forgotten in the history of North America. We think of the battles between the French and the English in North America as being the battles between the Redcoats and the regular French army, when in point of fact, many of these battles were fought by French Canadian militia and the French colonial militia, extraordinary men who were superb soldiers and superb woodsmen. And so because of their skill and because of their capacity to strike so quickly, they kept the British off guard. And it's only over time, and it takes the British a few years, frankly, to build up sufficient strength in North America simply to gradually sort of just simply overpower the French. It's like a steamroller coming forward. But it takes a long time for that to happen. And the French contest every inch of ground and give as much as they take.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening this morning in Champaign, and line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yes, mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you know why it was that Washington attacked the French in the first place.
That's a very good question, a very good question. George Washington was sent west by the governor of Virginia, a man named Governor Dinwiddie. Dinwiddie had heard, and on good authority, that the French were coming down the river valleys and, in fact, were in a place where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers come together, the place we know today as Pittsburgh. Governor Dinwiddie viewed this as a French invasion of his king's territory. Now, it didn't hurt, by the way, that Governor Dinwiddie, George Washington, and many other Virginians were land speculators, and they owned or claimed that they owned land in that region. And so if the French came in, not only would it be an invasion of their king's lands, but it would also potentially be a loss for them. So Dinwiddie sends Washington west to warn the French out. Washington is out there in the west, not far from the Allegheny Monongahela rivers, when he is told by his Indian scouts that there is a French party not too far away. And so Washington takes his militia and some of his Indian scouts and proceeds to go looking for the French. This French party had been sent out from Fort Duquesne, which is where Pittsburgh is today. The French party had been sent out for the same reason that Washington had been sent out. That is, the French party had been sent out to find the English and warn them away that this was the land of their king. They were not sent out to attack the English. That wasn't the point. This was a diplomatic mission. Well, Washington comes upon the French camp. It's very early in the morning at a place that's now called Jumonville Glen. There at Jumonville Glen, the French, who are still asleep, just barely getting up, it's very early in the morning, without warning, Washington surrounds the French camp and the English open fire on the French, kill several of the French, wound many more, and some of the French escape back to Duquesne. Why Washington did this? To this very day, it's uncertain. My own suggestion is that we always think of George Washington as the commander-in-chief of the American Army in the Revolution, of a man of great dignity and experience and perseverance and calm demeanor. Well, at this time, he's a young kid. And quite frankly, I think that Washington simply was inexperienced. He gave the wrong orders. He made a big mistake. Later, of course, in his career, he learns and grows from his mistakes. But there at Jumonville Glen in May of 1754, George Washington reacted in a way that was inappropriate. He fired first. And indeed, Horace Walpole, the great English writer of this time, when Walpole heard about what had happened there at Jumonville Glen, Walpole was reputed to have said, "Oh my God, this man has set the world afire." And indeed he had. So Washington, in a preemptive strike, I guess, and an unprovoked attack on the French.
Well, that's, I guess, gets at a question I have is whether, I don't know this is too trivial a way to put it, but whether such a thing would have been regarded as being in out of keeping with military practice of the time, it would have been considered to be a scurrilous, scandalous act to do what he did?
Well, it certainly was viewed that way by the French. And just to continue the story so your listener can appreciate the rich context of this, after this engagement at Jumonville Glen, Washington returns to his camp, and then later the French counterattack and actually defeat Washington, and Washington has to surrender. He surrenders to the French. And in the surrender document that Washington signed, the word assassination appears. Now, the story is told that Washington couldn't read French and that the candlelight was very bad, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is that in the capitulation that Washington signed several days after the event at Jumonville Glen, Washington admitted to assassinating the French. He later recanted that and said he didn't understand and it was not explained to him, et cetera, et cetera. But clearly, from my point of view, I would argue that it was an unprovoked attack.
Of course, the British regarded this as a great defeat and insult for them and decided that they needed to respond in force, maybe with greater force. And so the British sent British troops back to march on the fort, on Fort Duquesne, and
right.
It was a disaster for the British.
It was a disaster. You know, when one steps back and you look at the events of this leading up to the war, as the war grows in size, it is indeed that the modern term that we use, they would not have used in the 18th century, escalation, that everything that the British now do, the French match. And pretty soon you have this growing number of soldiers in North America. The war in North America begins to spread to Europe. And indeed, it's a war that begins in this remote place that no one's ever heard of. But it gradually spreads and becomes this war that engulfs the world.
It's interesting, too, that one of the, you know, when we're kids and we're told about the history of the Revolutionary War, one of these little bits of conventional wisdom that's always passed on is that, well, the reason that the colonial troops were successful is that the English insisted on marching in straight lines and the colonists would hide behind rocks and trees. And this was something that they learned from Native Americans. Here in this particular case, as I read it, indeed, the Americans and the British marched in straight lines, and it was the French and their Native American allies who took advantage of the cover, used guerrilla tactics, and that's part of perhaps the reason that they won so decisively at that time.
That's quite true. That the tactics employed by the French and the Indians were more inclined towards that ambush style, which they perfected very, very well, whereas the British held to traditional 18th century military tactics, and so too did their American allies. But a thing to remember about that is that we often imagine that one particular battle is indicative of the entire war. The great British defeat, Braddock's March, when the British general Braddock's army is virtually wiped out by the French and the Indians in an encounter there not far from Fort Duquesne. But that battle was unusual in the sense that it was indeed fought by the French and English who surrounded the British and did indeed wipe them out from behind trees and walls. But the major battles of the French and Indian War, even in North America, were pretty much conventional 18th century style tactics. The assault at Fort William Henry in upstate New York and Fort Ticonderoga, and indeed the epic battle on the Plains of Abraham at the city of Quebec itself. Those were very conventional military engagements. So while there was a fair amount of frontier warfare, which we always latch upon because it's so, we believe, so quintessentially American, that in point of fact, the major battles were pretty much fought on traditional standard 18th century tactics.
We have another caller here in Champaign. Again, line number one. Hello. Is there a caller there? Line one. Oh, there we got you. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. I think you did answer much of my question, but I was wondering which Indian tribes were on which side and what their impact was on the outcome of the war.
That's another very good question. In order to understand, I think, and to appreciate the role that the Indians played in this war, I like to use the concept that the Indians were, in fact, fighting a parallel war. That is to say, the Indians were caught between these two great superpowers, France and England. Truth of the matter is that neither superpower wished the Indians well. Now, in practice, the French were more amenable allies, simply because there were so many fewer French. And the French settlement in Canada was not so much a farming community as it was a fur trading community. So the French culture in Canada was reasonably compatible to the Native American culture. Quite the opposite in British North America. In British North America, the predominant culture was agricultural, farming, and families. And so they, the British North Americans, were taking the land. And so their culture was at odds with the Native American culture. But now, having said that, let me point out that the Native Americans understood this. In fact, you can read some of the very eloquent speeches that some of the chiefs made at the various meetings that were held. And indeed, one gets a sense in reading and thinking about what they were saying that they did understand the terrible, dire situation they were in. And so the Native Americans were likely to switch allies during the course of the war. That is, they would generally go with the side that was winning. Makes sense. And so when the French had the upper hand, you find that most of the tribes are, in fact, either openly allied or quietly allied with the French. As the French recede and are obviously losing, then you find that their native allies quickly remove themselves, sometimes just become neutral and sort of return to the West, or sometimes become allied with the British. But they're very conscious that they're trying as much, as best as they can, they're trying to balance these two empires for their own interests. Because in the end, they want to retain their culture, their sovereignty, their lands. And so they'll do anything to do that. If it means fighting for the French, they'll fight for the French. If it means fighting for the English, they'll fight for the English. So you find the Native moving back and forth across these lines quite often.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is William Fowler. He is director of the Massachusetts Historical Society. He's consulting editor at the New England Quarterly, honorary professor of history at Northeastern University, and is author of a recently published book a couple months ago, back at the beginning of the year, that looks at the history of the French and Indian War. The book is titled Empires at War, The French and Indian War and the Struggle for North America, 1754 to 1763. It's published by Walker and Company and should be in bookstore if you want to read it, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You sketched out how things developed here from the point where the British sent some troops led by George Washington to try to give the message to the French that they were not welcome in the Ohio Valley. They were beaten. They were sent back with the message from the French to the British saying, oh, yeah, says you.
Right.
Then the British send a larger force led by General Braddock to attack Fort Duquesne, and that was a rout.
That's
so
right.
Eventually what we get to the point here, I'm interested. It seemed like we get to the point from the British trying to flush the French out of the Ohio Valley, the French saying, no, we're not going anywhere, the British responding in greater force and losing, to get to the point where then apparently the British government decided the issue wasn't just that we have to drive the French out of what we think is our territory, that we have to drive the French out of the Americas.
Right. And that change in policy, that change in strategy comes with the emergence of William Pitt, who becomes the great war leader. William Pitt is sort of a 18th century version of Winston Churchill. Pitt decides that in the 18th century, wars happened all the time. And most of the wars were somewhat inconsequential. Nothing important happened. Well, Pitt is determined. He's a bulldog. And Pitt is determined that this war will be different. Once and for all, Pitt is determined that the British Empire will squash the French. And Pitt decides that this war will be won in North America. And so instead of depending upon these small frontier battles for this fort or that fort or whatever it happens to be, Pitt dispatches large numbers of troops, the fleet, and very good generals to North America to, as you just described, to once and for all deal with the French in North America to drive them out. In the meantime, the war is going on in Europe, and the British ally in Europe is Frederick the Great, the perhaps the world's greatest military genius of all times, the Prussian commander. And Frederick the Great is fighting off the Russians, he's fighting off the Austrians, he's fighting off the French, in just a remarkable series of battles. And Frederick keeps writing to Pitt, saying, send me troops, send me troops, send me troops. And Pitt will not send troops to Europe. He sends money to buy mercenaries, but he sends the bulk of the troops to North America, because that is Pitt's focus. And it works. It works. Pitt's strategy is triumphant, and North America falls to the British.
We have some other callers. Someone listening this morning in Indiana, in Kingman, Indiana. They're up next here, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. What a great topic. I love this topic.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to add a comment. You were talking earlier about we never hear about the French and Indian War. We always start with the American Revolution.
Yes.
But if you read some of the great biographies that are coming out, like James Madison, and there was one recently on George Washington, the founding fathers were college students in the late 1760s and the early 1770s, most of them.
Right.
And for them, the French and Indian War was, to my generation, what Vietnam is. It was the war of their fathers.
That's true. The difference being that it was the war of their fathers, but it was also a triumphant war.
Exactly.
It's interesting, if you look at the spirit of what's called them colonial Americans in 1763, 64, they loved the empire.
Mm-hmm.
William Pitt was their hero. You know, at no other time in the history of British North America did we feel as close to the empire, as proud to be Englishmen, part of this empire, than we did in 1763. So it was a great event in that regard. And I think you're absolutely right. It did shape a generation of people.
And I think two of the other things that helped shape that war in that era was the I don't know how to put it other than to just say that the absolute greediness of the land companies, like the Ohio Land Company.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you also had spoken yet about just the international system or the European system of purchasing rank and status through military acquisitions. And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Sure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Thanks for the call. It is true in the British Army of the 18th century that you purchased your commission. There was a fairly standard price list. Cost this much to be a lieutenant, this much to be a captain, et cetera, et cetera. And at the top of it all was the colonel, and the colonel was the commander of the regiment. And in many instances, the colonel virtually owned the regiment. He had bought his position. Now, that may seem pretty venal, and it may seem pretty corrupt, and in many ways it was. However, interestingly enough, somehow it worked. That is to say that while these men did buy their commissions, those who bought them were generally, obviously they came from families with some means, but they were generally experienced men. And so you find that, in one of those ways, and I guess the British Empire just sort of muddled through in so many ways, that this system of purchasing commissions did not necessarily hurt the army. The British were very, very suspicious because of the tradition of a standing army. They're very suspicious of a big army, and so that they always wanted to keep it small, and they generally did have a fairly small army. And they never organized it in anything bigger than regiments because they didn't want huge armies that might overthrow Parliament, as had happened before. And so they had a curious attitude towards the army. It was a sort of quasi-private operation where you bought commissions. But I must say, as one looks at it, as odd as it is, from a rational point of view, it seems very curious. But it did, in fact, produce a very good army. And the British Army of the 18th century was a superb, superb machine.
Just to get a question raised in my mind by also some of the callers, other comments, you know, nowadays we talk a lot about globalization and about the influence of commercial interests in geopolitics.
Right.
We do at this time certainly have a version of globalization, maybe not quite like what we have today, but was there a way in which commercial interests shaped or drove this conflict?
Absolutely. That was really at the heart of it. By the mid-18th century, it was clear, and this had developed over some generations, that England's future was in a colonial empire. She is, after all, an island. She could not really look to Europe for her future. Europe was composed of fairly powerful rivals, France and Prussia and Austria. And so if England was to grow, then she had to grow overseas. She emphasized her navy. And she emphasized overseas training, overseas trading. So it was clear to British leaders in Parliament and the ministers of the King that the future of England lay overseas. Now, that meant, of course, expanding the empire. In the 18th century, most people held the belief in what we would call today a zero-sum game. That is, for one empire to get richer, someone else had to grow poorer. The notion of economic growth was not well understood at that time. And so England did indeed see herself in a commercial rivalry, that for the nation to prosper, she had to constantly expand her markets. She had to constantly create and establish new colonies. And so very clearly, this imperial conflict between France and between England was an imperial commercial conflict.
Let's talk with another caller, and this would be someone here in Chicago, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I was very struck by your beginning conversation, which just summarizes saying you said that the reason why we have gaps in American history is because we don't know Canadian history.
Mm.
And I was wondering, it seems to me that's probably true about Mexican history.
Yes.
As well. And is there any one or are there any histories that attempt to integrate North American history that looks at the development of these three nations and tries to pull it together in some sort of coherent form?
I don't really know of any synthesis work that does that. That's an interesting challenge. It would be a great challenge for an historian to do that, an intriguing one when you think about it, because here in the colonial period, we're talking about three empires, and I don't talk about the third empire in my book except in a very peripheral fashion, and that is Spain.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. You have Spain, France, and Great Britain, England, struggling over who will dominate the North American continent. Who in fact, will the Spanish get here first, followed quickly by the French and the English, and eventually, of course, I guess we sort it out to the English. The French are driven off, and then eventually, Spain still exists in terms of a Spanish culture, a Latino culture here in North America. So the other point I would bring out, and I think your caller is quite right, that we often forget, too, that in these three nations, and we share the continent, we sometimes forget that Mexico shares our continent, you have indeed three different founding cultures, a Spanish culture, an Anglo culture, and a French culture, that have shaped the culture, the combined culture of North America. But the quick answer is I don't know of a good history that tries to integrate and explain and discuss and analyze the interactions amongst these three founding cultures. Good task.
Yeah, I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
You've used three terms, militia, mercenaries,
uh-huh.
and standing armies.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to get an understanding
sure.
of how these function at this time, because you always think of nation state as a standing army
mm-hmm.
being a major part of the state. And
right.
I know these countries were developed. Some of them weren't even countries yet, or they were small nations.
Right.
How was this working? Who had standing armies? Was there policy against standing armies, as you just said, for the British? Who used mercenaries and why? Why were people mercenaries? Were they from countries that had standing armies and had excess people who were trained? How does all of these three forms of military armed forces work?
Sure. First, to the militia. The militia were primarily in North America. The militia concept wasn't very prevalent in Europe at all. And by militia in North America, I mean men who were not professional soldiers, who were farmers or tradesmen or whatever occupation they might have, and who for periods of time each year, and it would depend on which colony, whether that they'd be called up to, a, shall we say, active duty, much like our National Guard, much like the National Guard. They'd be called to active duty and trained, and they would train for a few weekends, nothing terribly serious, by the way. And the militia were trained, and they were organized into companies and regiments, but their principal function was to defend the home ground. They would man the local forts. Very rarely would militia march to another region. That was not what they were intended to do. They were part-time soldiers who were intended to defend the homeland. That was their task. And by the way, there were militia in French Canada as well. The French did organize militia. Again, they were farmers who were called up for duty when there was a need to defend the city or to defend the homeland, in that case against the British or the Indians, and then they'd go back to their farming. So the militia. Then there's the standing armies. All major European nations had standing armies. Now, some nations had very large standing armies. Russia, Austria, and France had huge armies, hundreds of thousands of men. And these were regular, full-time soldiers who were paid by the government, paid by the king, and they were on duty all the time. Very, very expensive. One of the reasons those three nations I just mentioned seem to be constantly in economic difficulty is the cost of maintaining these standing armies was huge. I guess we can appreciate that in the 21st century. The cost of defense can be very high. In the case of England, she too had a standing army, but it was very small. The standing army in England, perhaps in ordinary times in the 18th century, might be something in the order of perhaps 20,000 men. Very, very small. Again, the English had a suspicion of standing armies. They didn't like standing armies. And they didn't have to have a large one because they were an island, and the Navy defended them. The European nations who had large standing armies needed those armies to defend their own borders. But in England, they had the benefit of being able to have that English Channel separate then from Europe. So they didn't need a huge standing army. They did need a good Navy. Mm-hmm. And then we come to the mercenaries. Well, mercenaries are pretty common in the 18th and 19th century. And these were men who would be hired by the king or by a government who were not of the same nationality, and they would be hired, paid fees, whatever the fees might be, to work for, to defend that empire. For example, during the French and Indian War, or during the Seven Years' War, the standing army in England couldn't be mobilized. They couldn't get enough men to serve quickly enough. So the king actually hired some Germans. And so there were German soldiers who were brought to England. This is before now. This is before the American Revolution. German soldiers were brought to England to stand by to defend England in case there was an invasion. There wasn't. And so those were the mercenaries. Most of the war, both in Europe and in North America, in this time period we're talking about, fought by militia and fought by the regular soldiers, regular British soldiers, regular French soldiers, and the regular Germans, Austrians, and French soldiers.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and again, I'd like to introduce our guest, William Fowler. He's director of the Massachusetts Historical Society and consulting editor at the New England Quarterly. He's honorary professor of history at Northeastern University. He's written a book about the American Navy titled Jack Tars and Commodores, and also a biography of John Hancock, the Baron of Beacon Hill, and also this book that we're talking about here this morning that's a history of the French and Indian War. That book is titled Empires at War, and the publisher on the book is Walker & Company. Just there is a long here, rich history of battles associated with this war that we really can't talk in great detail about, but maybe I could ask you to sketch it out, and maybe it's easiest to look at it in a sense in two major chapters or installments. The beginning part of the war where the French seem to be having their way, and then the other part where we have more British victories and ultimately culminating in that battle on the Plains of Abraham where the French are defeated.
Right. In the very early stages of the war, the French, because they have, in military terms, we sometimes refer to it as interior lines, That is to say that because of the geography, the French were centrally located and could strike out pretty quickly. I know that many of your listeners are familiar with the geography of the area, but to keep in mind that the geography of the area we're talking about, that is New England and what is today the province of Ontario and the province of Quebec and down towards the Ohio River, it's the water routes that are most important, the water routes. The water routes being the St. Lawrence River, the Great Lakes, the Allegheny, the Monongahela, the Mohawk River. And because the French were so expert in moving along these water routes, they moved very, very quickly at the beginning of the war. And so they struck quickly and defeated the British. The British were reeling back, just simply reeling back. But it's the old story about persistence and about what really matters in the end was simply the a war of attrition in many ways. And that while the French enjoy these early victories, gradually, as you mentioned, the British build up their strength in North America. Now, something here that is interesting, and that is that in terms of numbers of people and numbers of soldiers, the French actually had a great advantage. Their army was much, much larger than the British army. But two things happened. One, the British controlled the seas. The Royal Navy controlled the seas. So while there were thousands and hundreds of thousands of soldiers in France, they weren't of much use in North America because they couldn't get them there. Secondly, the truth of the matter is that France really didn't much care about Canada, that she was far more interested in European power politics. She was far more interested in grabbing land from Prussia. She was far more interested in what was going on at her own borders. In fact, on one occasion, a delegate from New France goes to Paris to entreat the king to send troops, to send more men to Canada. And the king and his ministers are reported to have responded to this person that when the house is on fire, one doesn't send men to put the fire out in the stables, meaning, of course, that Canada really didn't matter. So the British control of the ocean routes and the fact that the French really didn't much care about Canada means that as Pitt sends more and more men to North America, the end will come as gradually the noose sort of tightens around the French. As more and more redcoats arrive, as the Royal Navy arrives, the fortress at Louisbourg on Cape Breton Island falls in 1758, which opens the way up the St. Lawrence to the heart of New France. And the heart of New France, of course, is the city of Quebec. That is the heart of French Canada. And it's there that General Wolfe, James Wolfe, as neurotic a general as you could ever imagine, always sickly, always complaining, but nonetheless a very able commander, lays siege to Quebec. And it's there at that siege of Quebec and the final battle that the war turns.
The British eventually, the British have a victory there. The fighting does go on for a little bit after that.
Yes, it does.
But essentially, that the war is over at that point.
That's right.
And the British, so we have a British victory, and I guess I'm wanting to go on and make the connection to the Revolution. Because
sure.
Here, the British win, but this was very expensive for Britain. And the British feel that, after all, since this war was fought to protect the colonies, their thought was, well, who should pay for this war? The colonists should pay for this war. And here now we get into the situation that helps to set up, lay the groundwork for the American Revolution.
That's exactly right. All during the war, William Pitt and his successors had laid very heavy taxes on the British to fund the war, to pay for the war. And while they were doing that, they kept telling people, as they were selling them ever higher taxes, don't worry, when the war's all over, we'll be rich, our empire will grow, and the taxes will go down. Well, guess what happened? After the war is over, they face increasing expenses to maintain the empire, so taxes remain high. The national debt is huge, about £140 million, which is a lot of money at that time. And so, in order to pay off the national debt, and now to maintain this expanded empire, imagine for a moment, in 1763, what happened at the Treaty of Paris. More land traded hands than almost the entire expanse of Europe. I mean, a huge, huge change in territory. And the British have to govern this, defend it. And quite naturally, the men in Parliament, who have been paying heavy taxes, their constituents are all over them to lower their taxes. Who benefited most from the war? The British colonials in North America. They don't have to worry about the French raiding south any longer. And so it was very logical that the ministers in Parliament and the king looked to North America for a revenue. It was quite logical, and they thought quite rational. And thus begins about a dozen years from 1763 to 1775, in which they try to raise a revenue in America, and instead they raise a revolution.
Hmm. Well, I have another caller here, and let's talk with them in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm interested to hear what you have to say about Germany. I'm remembering back some and the term Huns, which were German mercenaries, I think, and the Germans in Mexico. And am I remiss in saying that they, I've read somewhere about the German presence in Mexico as an emperor, a transplanted emperor of some sort, in Mexican territories. I'll hang up and listen to your answer, sir. Thank you.
It's a little far afield. I don't know. Can you respond to that question?
The Germans that I'm talking about in the 18th century, there is no in the 18th century at the time of the French and Indian War, there is no such thing as Germany. In fact, the territory that we know as Germany today was a conglomeration of dozens of little principalities and duchies and kingdoms, the most important of those being Prussia, which was the dominant power. And I think what your caller is referring to in terms of the Germans in North America, it wasn't the Germans. It was at the time of our Civil War in the 1860s that the French established an emperor on the throne. They created the throne of Mexico, an emperor called Maximilian. And Maximilian was actually an Austrian. He was an Austrian prince. Seems all a little bizarre now when you think about it. But the French took advantage, while we were busy savaging one another during our Civil War, the French took advantage of our distraction and imposed Maximilian, this Austrian prince, onto this created throne of Mexico. And I think that's what your call is referring to.
Yeah. Just as a way of wrapping up, and I know you've touched on this a little bit earlier, but I think, it's interesting to talk a little bit about when you talk about who wins, who loses, that clearly the French lose. They lose their possessions in North America. The British win, although it sets the stage for the American Revolution. Of all of the people you would have to line up on the sides of winners and losers, you'd have to say among the losers probably were the Native Americans.
Without question. Without question. And in fact, the sad irony here, the tragedy of it is that on one hand, you know, I suspect we as descendants, frankly, of the British Empire and all of those things that we cherish today, many of the things that we cherish today are a direct result of the English system of government, et cetera, that in point of fact, the civilization, the culture, the empire that won was the one that was most at opposition to the native culture. And the victory of the British Empire really spelled doom for the Native Americans. And that bad situation for the Native Americans persisted, of course, after the American Revolution, because the American Revolution brought to power a nation that was equally hostile to Native Americans. And so the Native Americans lost in 1763, and one can argue that they lost again in the American Revolution. But I must take from that, though, having said that, that despite the terrible things that did happen to Native Americans, have happened to Native Americans over the last several centuries, it is a remarkable thing, and I think a hopeful sign, the persistence of Native culture, that when one thinks of the terrible ordeal that those people have been through and have been, and to some degree still endure, that the persistence of their cultural identity is something that perhaps gives us all a little bit of hope. I see that in the same way for the French Canadians. They, too, have a culture which they take great pride in and are preserving. But they, too, in many ways, lost in 1763. So here we have two peoples, French Canadians and Native Americans, both of whom have suffered greatly as a result of the triumph of arms of Anglo-America and then the United States. But in both cases, they're cultures that do persist, and their cultures are alive and well, and if not thriving, certainly doing very well today.
Yeah. Going back to just very quickly here, we're almost out of time, but that point where we started about people maybe having a hazy grasp on our history, and this is one event that's maybe hazier than most. Certainly people understand and will understand just how important the Revolution and also the Civil War were in shaping this country where we live today. And I think that certainly you want to add at least a couple of other conflicts as important and less well-known. One would be the War of 1812.
Yes.
And the other one would be this one, the French and yes. Indian War.
Yes.
In what ways do you think that this war ends up being a very important factor in shaping what kind of country the United States became?
Well, one can imagine that if the French and Indian War had not occurred, it's quite reasonable for me to think that the United States would, in fact, be today in a situation not dissimilar to Canada. That is, that we probably would not have had our revolution. We may well have struck a more independent pose as things went on, but we would not have had a violent revolution because we could not have afforded to do that as long as an enemy was on our border. We would be dependent and were dependent upon the empire. So we probably would have more or less stayed loyal to the king. And so today we'd quite likely be singing God Save the Queen. On the other hand, it's also quite possible that you might have had a kind of fracturing of North America. As we moved west, as new colonies were established, you can imagine that it wouldn't be the state of Iowa, it would be the colony of Iowa, or the royal colony of Montana, or whatever it happens to be, that you'd have a North American map that would look very, very, very different. And that it might indeed not only be a commonwealth, perhaps, the commonwealth of the states. It could even have been many, many individual states and nations here in North America. So the result of 1763 is very clearly the result that there will be a separation from the British Empire, and that there will be, to the north, Canada, which, of course, is still part of the Commonwealth of Nations.
Well, there we will leave it with the recommendation that if you want to read up on the French and Indian War, you look for the book we've talked about, Empires at War, published by Walker & Company, by our guest, William Fowler. He's director of the Massachusetts Historical Society. Mr. Fowler, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. It's been a pleasure.